Small world, big data.
Can you imagine 2 billion lines of code and 45,000 updates every single day? You know, it's an interesting discussion.
Hi, Mike Matchett with Small World Big Data. We are here with another wonderful episode of the Tech Top 6 with our great editor from the IT Weekly newsletter, Warren Avery. Warren, welcome once again.
Mike, as always, a true pleasure to talk to you, to see you, to get this stuff going. And I can't believe we've been doing this for almost a year. And I'm always excited to talk to you about what we find out there in this IT world. So I'm ready to go this week.
Secretly, Warren, we've been doing it for more than a year, but we'll pick on some dates next time.
Well, time flies when you're having fun.
When you're having fun, right? I know. What we do here, if you're just joining us, is we ask Warren to bring along the six most interesting articles that he's hand curated into the IT Weekly newsletter from the last week or so's articles that he's hand curated into the weekly newsletter. You do what, 10 to 15 articles a day?
I'm trying to do that. I've backed off just a little bit. So we're probably in that 8-to-10 ratio right now, but we've got well over 20,000 technical articles that you can put in by keywords. So if you're looking for GDPR, you put in GDPR and there's all the articles so you can see what's going on. And we don't cover companies. We don't cover products. We don't cover press releases. These are technical articles that if you had the time to go through these, you would find them of interest. And that's what we do for you.
Sort of a professional development course. You're hand curating the material found on the wide internets everywhere into the stuff that's hype-free, vendor-free, non-marketing, and just really stuff that's good to know.
Two additional caveats. One, it's absolutely free. And the second is we don't put any cookies out there. So if you go take a look at an article, you're not going to get a call in 20 minutes from somebody trying to sell you something. We don't do that. We provide it as a service.
That's awesome. And at the end of this episode, we'll tell you a little bit more about subscribing to the IT Weekly newsletter or signing up or following it and getting your hands on it every single day. All right, let's get into it, Warren. 7 things come up first here on our Tech Top 6. This is an article that has 7 things on contract management. Really, I'm not even sure what contract lifecycle management means. I mean, you sign a contract, don't you just have it till it runs out?
Well, it's that rank, but being a guy from the sales, I always looked at contract management as part of the sales prevention team. Once they send it over to contract, to legal, the whole thing slows down. But contracts are so important. And can you imagine a company like Google or Amazon, the number of contracts they have to keep track of? It's almost unimaginable without some sort of a contract life management piece of software. But when you get that sort of thing, there's 7 areas that you have to take a look at. One is that if you're still relying on a paper process to keep track of your contracts, you're going to get overwhelmed. And saving your contracts digitally enhances security, enables easier searching, reporting, analysis of contract data. And here's the other thing. Ask yourself, is your contract management system document-centric or data-centric? So many times they file contracts alphabetically when it has nothing to do with storage, security, operations. So take a look at that. Also, make sure that all the key stakeholders across the organization are consulted on the design of a contract management system. Anyone that touches your contract, legal, sales, marketing, IT, finance, procurement, they all need to be involved in it. Here's the other thing. Is your contract management system integrated? So, for example, if you've got a CLM, contract lifecycle management, and CRM, customer relationship management, does it allow the accurate information to be transferred back and forth? And here was the last time. When was the last time you reviewed your whole contract management process? Contracts are not a set and forget it procedure. They've got to be reviewed. And here's the other thing. Are you using automation to help manage it? Automating it improves efficiency and compliance. And get your contracts under control. It saves time and money. And here's a big thing I found out from all the years. If you're dealing with a single company with lots of contracts, make them coterminous so they all expire at the exact same time. You can save money, and it's a big savings all the way around from both time and money.
I know that if you have lots of contracts, and contracts tend to creep up in number over time as different parts of your business buy different components from vendors, it does make a lot of sense to keep bundling those up and make them co-terminate and make them larger enterprise deals. You can save money. The vendor actually appreciates it as well because they don't have to spend as much on their sales cycles
re-upping. And here's the other thing. How many contracts you may have that have expired that you don't use anymore that you're still paying for?
I imagine that could be a problem if you're still writing a check every month on a contract that died 3 years ago.
Exactly.
So that's 7 questions to ask about contract lifecycle management. Definitely a way to save money if your business isn't really paying attention to that, or at least in IT, you're not paying attention to it. Here's maybe something you can dig into going into the end of the year here and try to claw back some funds. Look up contract lifecycle is the phrase, contract lifecycle, on the IT Weekly newsletter. If you're interested in this article, you just go there and type in the phrase for the articles that we're going to give you, and you'll find the specific article. If you want to get a little more general, just type in contracts and you'll get a dozen or so articles. If you type in lifecycle, Warren, I'm sure you'll get 1,000 things, but
yep.
It's like going on a fishing expedition there. All right. When you're contracting, you're sort of at the end of the chain, but at the start of that sort of vendor relationship, you want to look at architectures. You want to look at your technical architectures, but I don't think a lot of people are really cognizant of when you say technical architect, what does that encompass? What does the phrase technical architecture mean?
Yep. I'm seeing it more and more. It used to be system engineering, whatever it is. Now you're seeing a title technical architect. And technical architecture, the process describes, evaluates, and plans the evolution of information technology. And it basically, it's the process of moving from what you have to what you need. And to do this, you need to have some basic ideas. And this is a great article that gives you that sort of an idea of when you're evaluating any upgrades. For example, functionality. Does the component, whether it's software or hardware, do what the business needs to do or doesn't it? Flexibility. How well does a component adapt to new and changing situations? And companies are dynamic. Stability and performance. In an application platform, infrastructure, a component that crashes a lot or miserably slow is not going to be the solution. Internal engineering. How well is a component put together and does it conform to your engineering standards? Make sure it fits into your organization. Integration and interfaces. How does the exchange of data with other applications and data repositories synchronize? And how about overlapping data? That's a concern. How about adherence to architectural principles? If you've got architectural principles or engineering principles, make sure the technology conforms to them. You don't want to have disparate systems out there. And security, for example, most intrusions these days are a result of social engineering, but that doesn't mean the technology doesn't need to be hardened. So pay attention to security. Vendor and product viability. You got to make sure that the company is going to be around. It has some critical mass in the marketplace. And will it be around, supported, enhanced? And here's the other thing. Will you be able to get people to work on this product? There's no sense in bringing a product in that there aren't anybody to support it. And health of lower layers. I found that interesting, is that everything builds up and components in one layer rely on components at lower layers. And if you've got a bad product somewhere down there, the health and deficiency of those lower layers are going to bite you. And the other thing, redundancy. A component is redundant when other functionally similar or other alternatives are doing the same thing. Make sure you're not buying something that is not redundant. So technical architecture is a critical part of any IT department, and knowing what you have and what you need to get to where the business solutions are going to be is so very important. So technical architecture takes you from where you are to where you want to be.
I found that fascinating that it's not about building an edifice, right? We think of architecture in a building sense, like I'm building some big structure and it's fairly static and live for the ages. And what you're really saying here with this article is it's a process of change, moving from where you are to where you need to be and constantly upgrading things and, you know, adhering to different standards as they evolve. So very much more dynamic view of architecture and what an architect means.
Exactly. I had a misconception of what technical architecture was. This is a great article to get a handle on what that means to you and your company.
And if you're looking for this article, technical architecture will be the phrase to type in on the IT Weekly newsletter website. If you're interested in the topic, if you put in infrastructure, you'll get a couple hundred articles. It looks like 250 so articles on IT infrastructure. So if you're just curious what it means to be an architect, or you've got a promotion to be an architect, or looking to hire an architect, check these out and you'll maybe be able to find some phrasing and words and bullet points that you can use. This is really great, Warren. I noticed this week, by the way, you didn't really bring along a lot of articles on security.
I didn't. You know, probably 50% of everything I see out there is security. And I thought, well, this week, I'm just going to explore some other areas out there outlined to let you know an idea of what the newsletter is all about. We have a wide area of interest. And you know, security is obviously a big one, but it's not the only thing.
You're kind of throwing me for a loop here because we've been talking about security a lot, and now we're actually going back. But like you said, a lot of what goes in the IT Weekly newsletter is on broader topics and security. So,
yep.
So with that in mind, let's talk about privacy because very different than security, Warren. But in specific, people are looking at Christmas time. I'm looking for gifts already for Christmas. And you know, a lot of people say, hey, wouldn't it be cool to get these gadgets for in-laws or for whatever that are the Nest thermometers or the smart devices or the – in this case, you got an article on the Ring doorbell. Everyone's got those, right? And that's the thing with the camera in it, right? It's on their door. Yes. And yeah.
I read this article. I thought, right thing was, you have got to be kidding. But it's out of CPO magazine, and it's called the Ring Smart Doorbell Found to Be an Invasion of Privacy. Not only that, but the guy that installed these things is going to get a fine of $100,000 because of GDPR. And what happened is that the judge found that the Ring Smart Doorbell filmed a neighbor's property, was 40 feet away, and he said it was an invasion of privacy. And not only that, but he was charged with being a data controller since he was collecting all the data. Now, to be forthcoming, this was not just a single Ring out there, but an excessive number of doorbells with one specifically aimed at the neighbor's front door, which was 40 feet away. And the data controller issue came from a GDPR definitions by virtue of recording the neighbor whose front door was only 40, both the video and the audio. So adding to the judge's decision was a person installing all the doorbells became very aggressive when the person told them that they were infringing upon their privacy. Turns out the homeowner had to move, which was another one. So anyway, no one believes that this is going to be a far-reaching case, but the implication is clear. Be careful if you go overboard installing security cameras around your property that you could be charged with invasion of privacy. I just thought it was an interesting article all the way around.
I know people are watching those things at work to see who's dropping off packages, who's stealing packages off the porch, you know, when the kids get home, and they can see cars going by in the street and sometimes into that neighbor's yard and seeing what's going on over there. So that is a little bit of a privacy problem. And, you know, we've talked before about privacy concerns in Europe, GDPR, right? And we're seeing increasing privacy. We've covered a couple articles recently, pre-privacy laws here in the United States, right? Recently, we talked about
CCPA and CCPR, both from California. So,
right. And there was an Ohio one we talked about not too long ago.
Yep.
So if you're interested in privacy, check out some of our past podcast episodes not too long ago. This article, by the way, can be found under Smart Doorbell. And if you're interested in the broader topic, type in something like privacy or GDPR. There's over 400 articles that'll come up with GDPR in them. It's such a hot topic. So check it out. And by the way, while this is a sort of about your personal house, putting Ring doorbells up, this definitely applies to work conditions and workspaces too. You know, how many people have cameras up in their workspace that the boss is looking at or security's looking at? And you sort of forget about them after a while, but they tend to multiply after a time and reduce the amount of private spaces that are there. So keep an eye on that.
And what you and I have talked about for a while, Mike, is that there's no doubt in my mind personally that there will eventually become a national privacy regulation, just like the EU has GDPR. California is doing it. There's something like 17 or 20 states that are actually looking at these privacy laws. Sooner or later, somebody, Congress has got to take up this battle, and it is going to be a mess. There's no doubt about it.
All right. From privacy, let's turn to the idea of repositories. I know even my son is working on a coding project with one of his friends. They're in junior high, and they both installed Git and GitHub and are pushing and pulling and branching and merging. I'm sort of familiar with that, but they are not getting into it at, you know, the ages of 14 and 15. They're all learning how to get push, pull, and merge, which is, for those of you who aren't aware, in developer language, that's how you manage your code repositories. You've got an article here, though, that's talking about there's different kinds of repositories, and the names here sound vaguely like diseases or medications. Mono repos, poly repos, multi repos. What's going on here? Yep. What do all these different phrases now mean for repositories?
It's an article out of InfoWorld called The Case Against Mono Repos. And like you said, repo stands for repository. And the first time I read the article, I sort of passed on it because I didn't understand it. But then I started thinking about it. I said, I got to go back and read this. And it took a while to understand what was going down. So if you break down the words, you find out what they're really about. A repo stands for repository, and that's where your code is stored. The first part explains what each term means. Mono means one, where each application is stored in its own space. Poly meaning there are lots of application repositories. And what this article is discussing is an individual code repository and application code wide repository. And the article discusses the pros and cons, and they use Google, who is a mono repos company, and they put everything into one big repository. And if you can imagine, Google has 2 billion lines of code, okay, using 40 terabytes of storage. Guess how many updates they make to that code every single day? Over 45,000 changes. And what this article talks about is that if you put all your eggs in one basket, how do you manage it and control it? And they're saying that there's no doubt that the mono repos have an application, but the poly repos is where you should be looking at. It's easier to control the security, the access, all the way around. So they gave an example of entry point functions. If you're changing it, there's one massive change that can go in and it affects a lot of people. So I just found this whole article just absolutely interesting when you're doing codes and putting all your code into one repository is probably not in your best interest. Take a look at this article, understand the difference between mono and poly, and think about where you're going to be. Google did not start out to do a mono repository. It just grew into it. And the guy says in this article, I'm sure that if they were to think about it after the fact, they would have liked to have segmented it more, but it just sort of got out of hand.
It's hard to argue, though, Warren, with Google, you know, the mono repository. And the whole point of a code repository is a central master copy that you share back out. So I'm curious about the subtleties here with the poly repos approach, which fragments things. And it seems like if you fractionalize stuff out, you don't have a central control point anymore, but maybe that's kind of the point.
It's an interesting article, and I'm with you. I can understand a mono repos area and a poly repos, but can you imagine 2 billion lines of code and 45,000 updates every single day? It's an interesting discussion. But anyway, it's a great article about that.
All right. So if you're at all interested in the subtleties of repository architectures and whether there's different modes that might be suitable for what you're building, check out this article, Mono Repos, one word. Mono Repos will get you this article on the IT Weekly newsletter. If you're just interested in some other things, you can just type in repositories, probably find a bunch of articles. Containers will get you 160 articles. There's lots of different things going on here on the IT Weekly newsletter. So type in your favorite buzzword and go for that. All right, let's switch to article number 5 here today. We had an article recently which was about the questions you could ask your IT vendors, or the questions that you should ask your IT vendors, which I thought was fascinating. Looks like you found another article in that kind of vein of thinking about working well with your vendors and coming up with a better relationship. What's the advice here about working better with the people who supply you your stuff?
It's an article out of Business to Community. It's called Get the Most Value Out of Working with Tech Vendors. And working with tech vendors is a great question. I was in sales for over 50 years. And the thing that I had with most of my most successful customers is the relationship. But you have to understand that whenever you're talking to new vendors, change is imperative. And people don't like change, whether it's software or hardware. And there's that old adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Back in the days, I had to sell against IBM. And this was in the day when IBM literally owned the data center. And believe me, that old saying, no one got fired for buying IBM. That's true. So I had to wait around until either they shot themselves in the foot or had some product they couldn't match. And fortunately, I was one of the first salespeople with EMC when they brought out their disk system. But that's a whole nother story about how that evolved. So there are some areas that you want to do. Number one, do your research. Nothing scares a vendor more than walking into a customer who knows what the market is and has some definite questions. Also, attend some user conferences and events. Not only can you see the product in work, but also you can also see other vendors at the same time. Keep an open mind. New solutions often cause people to compare the new solution to an old one. And change is never easy, especially for software. So keep an open mind when you're looking at it. Here's the other big thing. Have regular meetings with a vendor. No install goes smoothly. And if you have regular meetings, you can address it before it blows up into a big, big problem. And here's the other thing that's always interesting. Request additional training. Normally, everybody will provide some training, but before you sign on the contract, get some additional training, because training after the fact can be expensive. So, you know, developing a solid relationship with a new vendor can take time, but it can be done. And here's a sales tip that I learned. Okay, before you enter negotiations, find out when the fiscal year ends for the vendor. And I'll tell you, every single company I ever worked with or did, when it comes to the end of the quarter or the end of the year, they will make you a smoking deal. So find out. That's a key piece of information that you have to add. Your vendor won't like it, but it'll put you into a good negotiating place.
You know, Warren, we're going to find it hard to get some vendor sponsors on this show if we keep giving all these tips and clues of how to, you know, turn the screws and levers on your vendors.
And now that you mentioned that, you're right. I shouldn't start go around telling the secrets, right? So
maybe that's the thing. And then they'll come along and sponsor us so we don't spill everything, at least not at first, right? So you remember, you know, co-terminate your contracts from that earlier article. Here, you know, make sure you keep in constant contact and negotiate near the end of the year and the end of your contracts for that. And ask for those extras like training. So a lot of ways to get that. If you're interested in this article, by the way, tech vendors, two words, will be the catchphrase for this on the IT Weekly newsletter. And if you just want to know about vendor relationships, just type in something like vendors and see what that gets you. Probably over 100 articles at this point. All right, Warren, article number 6, our final article for today, is on data governance. We started with an article with 7 things in it, and we're finishing an article with 7 things in it. So I don't know if there's some kind of symmetry you had going on in your mind here about bracketing our articles with 7. But in terms of governance, we see people, first of all, not really understanding what governance means, right? They think, oh, I'm protecting my data. I must be governing it. I'm like, not really. So in addition to not knowing what governance is, they obviously make a lot of mistakes about it. So tell us a little bit about the article here and what kinds of things they might be doing wrong.
Yep, it's an article out of CIO Magazine. It's called 7 Data Governance Mistakes to Avoid. And Mike, as we've discussed in the past, companies get confused with the difference between compliance and governance. Compliance is the law. Governance is the policies, procedures, and practices to ensure that your companies comply with compliance. And these are things like GDPR, CCPA. Compliance laws are evolving both internationally and domestically. And think about the new California CCPR, which is going to an effect slowly. So you've got to get your governance in place. And so here are the mistakes that companies are making. They're treating data governance as a technology project. You've got to constantly evaluate the amount and type of data that is being collected. And that is not a technology question. Neglecting to convey data governance overall business value. Effective data governance programs are aligned and mapped to business goals. They're not standalone projects. Failing to draw data owners into the data governance process. Governance does not mean ownership of the data. Get the data owners involved early and often. Also, overlooking the impact assessment. Understand the who, what, when, where, how the data has been collected, and the disclosure and the processing of that data. Defining data governance without the infrastructure to uphold it. So many companies go into a governance project and they don't have the infrastructure. Build the infrastructure first before launching it. Also, companies are forgetting that data governance education is ongoing. Have regular training sessions for employees to understand the governance policies, procedures, and practices. It's not a one and done process. And here's the other thing. You've got to have a strong leader. The buck stops there. You've got to have one person because they're going to be dealing with the C-levels, with the data owners, every part of the company. You've got to have a strong person there. So governance is not a question of if, but a question of when. And the sooner companies realize the importance of governance and policies, the better off they're going to be. So understand compliance, but more importantly, understand governance.
It's interesting when looking at these tips that some of them overlap with previous articles or other articles in different areas, you know, like make sure you have a strong leader, getting buy-in, making sure you include all the stakeholders. Those seem like pretty consistent pieces of advice. And it surprises me that there are folks out there who would forget that with every new project that they get into and need to be reminded about it on there. But evergreen kinds of things. And it's interesting also if you're paying attention to the IT Weekly newsletter and the articles we're covering, you start to learn this stuff and pick it up, Warren. I'm feeling like I'm becoming an expert in some of these things just tangentially.
Well, you know, my experience, people ask me why I don't write articles and stuff. And my knowledge and my experience is 1 foot deep and 50 miles wide. I know a little about a lot, but I'm not your in-depth sort of guy. And that's what I try to do is cover that entire spectrum, leadership, operations, security, compliance, you name it. If it's in the IT world, I'll find it out there.
All right. Governance mistakes is the key word for that one. Governance alone will find you almost 150 articles. And Warren, you mentioned before the IT Weekly newsletter doesn't use cookies. How much does it cost?
It's absolutely free. Just go out there, take a look at itweeklynewsletter.com. People look at our website and they say, well, it's not very modern. Well, I'm not concerned with what it looks like. I'm concerned with the contents. I've got great stuff down there, but I'm not going to spend the money to make this all flashy and everything. And I'm not going to do that. I'm interested in the content. So don't look at the website as being indicative. Put in some term that you're looking for and see what pops up. And they're current. There's nothing worse than putting in GDPR and finding something from 2017. These articles are normally within the last, you know, 1 to 7 days. So they're all.
And you update it daily. So if you go there every day, you'll find the last daily new articles. So you can actually have this part of your morning coffee routine, which means it should really be called the IT Daily Newsletter or something like that.
I know, Mike, but I'm so attached to the IT
Weekly. You're attached to the name. I know. When we go online. By the way, you're not that backwards because we're doing a podcast. This is what some of the cool kids do these days. Yep. I mean, next we're going to do some TikToks and Instagrams and stuff like that, right? We'll get you up to speed here.
Ooh. Hey, let's send out a thanks to Michelle Rado, who's our producer, who watches over us. Last week, she let us go by ourselves and it made life really, really hard for us. So Michelle always takes what we do and makes it nice and smooth. And if anybody needs that sort of help for a podcast or anything, Michelle, and the name of the company is what? Flying Pig, right?
Flying Pig Audio, if you're interested. Yeah. Flying Pig Audio has a website. Check it out. And then it's Michelle. Tell her, in fact, that we sent you, and maybe she'll be nicer to us next week.
No, I don't think so, but that's all right. So.
No, she's really super sweet. And finally, you know, I'm an analyst, and I have my website, Warren. I don't know if you know that, Small World Big Data. It's actually where we host the podcast, Tech Top 6. So come to smallworldbigdata.com if you're interested in finding the homepage for the podcast itself. We've got all the past versions there. You can listen to them there or in your favorite media player. We're in all the directories if you want to follow along. And if you want, you can go to the website and find the links to things like Apple iTunes and iHeartRadio and all the rest of that and click on there. There's also a form there, Warren, that you can just fill out and hit send and it comes directly to us and you don't have to be worried about any zero trust issues or email interception or whatever else. So
yeah. And if there's a company out there that wants somebody interviewed, they want to develop their own podcast and are looking for two highly professional trained individuals, we can do that. We can talk to somebody and put a podcast together for them. And Michelle will wrap it all up and make it something that you can put on your website or go to a trade conference show and have it gone there. So we're available for it to help you out.
In particular, you're also, if you're interested in even sponsoring the Tech Top 6, the IT Weekly newsletter, or in some rich analyst-driven content, lead gen or event hosting, give us a call. We're a consortium, Warren. We've got all the bases covered here.
We do. So anyway, Mike, as always, a true pleasure talking to you. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks and see what else is new out there.
All right. Look forward to it. Take care. Catch up with things and be sure and follow us on your favorite podcast network. Take care. Bye.
This has been a Small World Big Data Podcast.